This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Future Farm Botanicals Liquid Wild Oil of Oregano with rosemary extract and natural honey flavor. Future Farm's Wild Oil of Oregano supports a variety of healthy benefits, including antimicrobial effects, as well as supporting the immune system. Plus, Future Farm is the first ever to formulate Wild Oil of Oregano with rosemary. Rosemary aids circulation, helps alleviate muscle pain, improves memory, and also gives your immune system a boost. The natural honey flavor enhances the taste while still giving you all of the benefits. For more information and to order, call 888-841-7216, 888-841-7216, or go to myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. That's future, P-H-A-R-M, myfuturefarm.com/Hoffman. Wild oil of oregano is all natural, science-based, and works without adverse side effects. MyFutureFarm.com/Hoffman. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to talk to an extraordinary individual who is spearheading an effort to tackle one of the most challenging problems that faces our generation from a medical standpoint, and that's the problem of cognitive decline. He's Dr. Dale Bredesen, and he's written a landmark paper. It's created a big splash. It appeared in the medical journal Aging in September of 2014. Entitled Reversal of Cognitive Decline, a Novel Therapeutic Program. And it is a multifaceted approach to the problem of cognitive decline, which sometimes morphs into full-blown Alzheimer's disease. Dr. Bredesen is a medical doctor. He's internationally recognized as an expert in the mechanisms of neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's. Graduated from Caltech, got his MD at Duke, and he served as chief resident neurology at the University of California, San Francisco. He has held faculty positions at University of California, San Francisco, UCLA, and UC San Diego. And Dr. Bredesen directed the program on aging at the Burnham Institute before coming to the Buck Institute in 1998 as its founding president and CEO. Now, the Buck Institute is a place, it's kind of a think tank, where researchers get together to tackle problems related to aging. And, this, is a very, very vital effort, because we're confronting an unprecedented epidemic of neurodegenerative diseases. So without further ado, here's Dr. Bredesen. It's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Thanks very much, Dr. Hoffman. Good to be here.
Okay, so can you define the scope of the problem for us? How big a problem is it? And, of course, we have an aging population of baby boomers. What's going to be happening?
This is a huge and growing problem. It is arguably the number one problem in healthcare today. You could argue that the greatest area of biomedical failure has been the failure to treat neurodegenerative diseases successfully. You know, we all know a survivor from cancer. Nobody knows an Alzheimer's survivor. And when we've indeed, in the paper you mentioned, described the first people where we can reverse the problem early on in its course. If you just look at what this country spends on this one problem, Alzheimer's disease, it was over $220 billion last year. As you know, the increase is going to bankrupt Medicare in the next decade or two. So major problems coming. And the number that's often thrown out is 5.2 million Americans have Alzheimer's disease. But that's actually a very misleading number. What you really want to know, since, you know, many people are too young to know that they're going to get it, the number you really want to know is, out of the 318 million Americans currently living, how many will develop Alzheimer's during their lifetimes? And the answer is 45 million of us. If we don't do something about prevention, we'll develop Alzheimer's disease during our lifetime of the currently living Americans. So this is a staggering number. It's about 15% of the population. And beyond that, one simple genetic risk factor, which is the most important one, which is ApoE status. If you have zero copies of ApoE, the epsilon-4 allele, referred to as ApoE4, your chance of getting this illness during your lifetime is about 9%. If you have a single copy, it's about 30%. And if you have two copies, in other words, if you're a homozygote, your chance is about 90%. So there are 7 million Americans who are APOE4 homozygotes, i.e. they have two copies, and almost all of them will end up getting Alzheimer's if we don't identify them and help them prevent the problem, which is one of the goals here. There are 75 million Americans living with a single copy who are at about 30% risk, as I mentioned. So this is a huge and growing problem and something that we're now finally able to do something about. But of course, the standard has been that you hide it, that you don't go in until very late because you know there's nothing that can be done about it, et cetera. So we need to change the dialogue in this area.
Well, what about progress towards a drug cure? You know, there are actually several drugs on the market which are targeting Alzheimer's disease, and literally tens of billions of dollars are being expended on research racing to find, quote, in parentheses, the cure, in quotation marks, the cure, capital C. And you highlight what you term the failure of monotherapeutics. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, what I mean by that is very simple. The idea of taking a single drug, a monotherapeutic, and healing a complex chronic illness actually does not make a lot of biological sense. And a simple way to look at this, for example, is just look at what happened with HIV. Now, HIV is much simpler. It's a simple little retrovirus, very much simpler than Alzheimer's disease. And as you know, with that, it took three drugs to make a big impact. So the idea of curing Alzheimer's with a single drug actually makes very little biological sense. Now, having said that, it's still important to develop the drugs. They're going to be very good when used with an overall program. And that's going to be, I think, very helpful. That's the goal. But again, look at what happened. Cancer has been using multi-therapeutics, polypharmacy, since the 1960s. So actually, the approach to Alzheimer's is somewhat out of date. We're still looking for this one drug that's going to have the big impact. And for example, if you just look at one decade from 2002 to 2012, as you said, billions of dollars were spent. There were 244 clinical trials for Alzheimer's disease during that decade. 243 failed outright, and a single one, which was memantine, quote, succeeded. But of course, the success was very, very minimal. And so, This is a real problem. And in fact, going forward, we need to have approaches where we can combine various drugs and various non-pharmaceutical approaches to address the biology of this complex chronic illness.
Well, some people assert that cognitive decline, as we see it now, is merely a consequence of the fact that we have better therapies to extend people's lives. That's an inevitable process of aging and, you know, the consequence of curing or delaying death from heart disease and other factors is that more and more people are going to develop dementia. Do you take that position, or do you think there's more to it, or there's a Western disease or a lifestyle disease or environmental causes?
Yeah, I disagree with that claim, and here's why. There are people who are living, you know, beyond 100. There are people who are 110 years old who do not have significant cognitive decline, who actually do very, very well. And it is very common when you actually look to see what is causing the problem, very much like looking at what is causing cardiovascular disease. You can identify specific factors. And in fact, when you correct those factors, you see a change. Again, let's go back. When I was in medical school, which was way, way back in the 70s, we were taught that you could not reverse heart disease, that you put down that plaque, it's in your coronary arteries, and the best thing you can do is when you need one to have a bypass. Of course, along came Dean Ornish, and then along came Caldwell Esselstyn, and what did they teach us? They showed us that, hey, if you do the right things, you can actually show that you get on the good side of that threshold, you're actually starting to pick up the plaque instead of continuing to put the plaque down. So as Dr. Esselstyn says, this is a foodborne illness, which is a good way to think about it. And we look at cognitive decline in a similar way. The mechanisms are somewhat different. They're not identical. But again, there are many things, and yes, it's genetics and exposure, but there's a tremendous amount of environment, things like nutrition, exercise, sleep, stress, hormonal balance, hygiene, you know, on and on and on, that you can identify And in fact, getting this for the vast majority of people, and I won't say 100%, but for the vast majority of people, this is an avoidable problem.
Ed, your paper is entitled Reversal of Cognitive Decline, a Novel Therapeutic Program. Let's skip to the punchline. We'll get into the details during this podcast, but what happened? You looked at a small group of patients. You took 10 patients. They utilized a very complex program that we'll get into the details about. And what was the outcome?
Right. So this is a small part of a much bigger story. We have had the lab up and running. I worked with two different Nobel laureates as I was training, and we started my own laboratory back in 1989, so we've had it up and running for 27 years now. We've been studying in the laboratory what are the fundamental mechanisms that underlie the phenomenon of neurodegeneration. Why is it that we actually get Alzheimer's disease so frequently? What is actually driving the process, and what can you do about it? So back in 2011, we found that there were many different factors that all contribute to what we call a plasticity balance. So much like you can look at osteoporosis as an imbalance between osteoblastic activity and osteoclastic activity, i.e. laying down of bone versus picking up bone, we found that there were dozens and dozens of signals. We initially identified 36. They're probably going to be fewer than 100, but it will be somewhere in there. And we identified all these signals that contribute to a balance between synaptoblastic activity, in other words, laying down and making of connections in your brain, literally remembering, versus synaptoclastic activity. And so, for example, you know, we're all actively forgetting the seventh song that played on the radio on the way to work yesterday. And throughout our lives, we identify the most important things, and we keep those, and then we throw out the things that are less important. So we could see then that there were many, many different factors that all fed into this balance. Everything from your estradiol level, your progesterone level, your estradiol to progesterone ratio, your vitamin D, whether you're under stress, your cortisol level, on and on and on, dozens and dozens of things that feed into both the synaptoblastic side and the synaptoclastic side. You can see this at the molecular species level. And so back in 2011, then, we proposed the first comprehensive trial to the Australian IRB, both the public and private, that included the entire program, and then with and without a drug. So it was a double-blind, placebo-controlled drug trial with or without this this whole group, this program, the protocol. And we were turned down, and they said, you know, first of all, it's too complicated. And second of all, they said, obviously, you guys don't understand how to do a clinical trial because right. You only change one variable.
Exactly. You do one thing
trial.
At a time. You'll study like one
exactly.
medication or one vitamin.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly right. And so we said, of course, you guys don't understand how this disease works. This is not a univariable disease. And so what we tell the patients is, imagine you have a roof with 36 holes in it. A drug is an excellent cover, very good for one hole. And so you need to cover some other holes before you're actually going to be able to see whether that drug is doing its job or not. In the long run, I think this will be, going forward, the way to test new drug candidates. And I think this is the way the drugs will actually work the best. My suspicion is a number of these drugs that have actually failed were probably doing very well, but they just weren't covering enough holes. Mm-hmm. We were asking them to do too much, in other words. So after we were turned down in 2011, of course, very depressed, and we were trying to figure, you know, how are we going to get IRBs to understand this? People started to approach me, and actually the first person was someone who works for the government, who actually lives back on the East Coast. It's a very typical story. Her mother had passed away from Alzheimer's disease, and she was beginning to have similar symptoms. She'd been to see her doctor already, who said, yeah, you have the same thing your mother had. And of course, when he wrote in the chart memory problems, she went and tried to get long-term care insurance, and she was unable to get it because of what he had written in the chart. And so she decided to commit suicide. Luckily, before she committed suicide, she called a friend of hers who happened to know about some of our work, and sent this woman out, and we spent almost 3 hours going through the whole thing. So I said, look, you know, here was the thing we were trying to do in Australia. You're welcome to take this back to your doctor. All I can say is, you know, this was the plan for Australia, but, you know, we're not going to be able to do that trial. So indeed, she was very incentivized, having seen what her mother went through. And she did take this back to her doctor, and they started working together. And I got a call from her 3 months later saying, I can't believe it. Not only am I back to normal, not only am I back at work full time, but in fact, my memory is better than since I was in my 30s. So we were very enthusiastic. We've had over 100 people now come through to do this program that we proposed for the Australian trial. And we've had tremendous results. As you said, we published just the first 10. And so, of course, that's a very tiny number. We recognize that. And we are starting now two additional, larger trials. Meanwhile, though, we've had very good results with the people coming through. We have another paper that will be coming out in the next few weeks to document increases in things like, MRI, hippocampal volumes, and neuropsych quantitative testing and those sorts of things to show that this is not simply some sort of placebo effect. This is an objectively quantifiable improvement and a very striking one for many people.
Yeah, and of course, this goes against the orthodoxy because back when we were in college and grad school, after a night of hard partying, we would wake up with a hangover and we would go, gee, I wonder how many brain cells we killed off then. Well, it's a good thing we have 3 billion brain cells because, we only lost a few thousand last night. But it turns out that not only can you arrest the progression of loss of neurons and neural connections, you can actually regenerate the brain. I guess that's what the term plasticity entails.
Yeah, very good point. And I think that the corollary to what you just said is that we don't know yet when we see these people who have increased hippocampal volumes. And by the way, others have now published this sort of thing too. Dr. Fatuhi, originally from Hopkins, who's got a practice in Virginia, just recently published an article where he was showing increases in hippocampal volume with a program that involves exercise and several other things as well. They're seeing improvements as well. So this is something that is out there. Now, we don't know yet, nor does he, nor does anyone yet, when you see this increase in hippocampal volume, is this going to turn out to be attributable to greater survival of stem cells, for example? Is it going to turn out to be something that's an increased arborization? Is it going to be increase in glial support? Or is it going to be all of the above or something else? We don't know yet, but we do know that you can look and actually see an increase in hippocampal volume.
So let's take a deeper dive on what the program actually entails. We do various tests to assess people's health. And for example, we'll check homocysteine, we'll check B12, C-reactive protein, insulin, vitamin D levels, certain vitamin levels. Your contention, and you lay it out in this paper, is that the standards we have for these things, they're okay for staving off, major diseases like pernicious anemia, stroke, overt stroke due to super high homocysteine, but they're not enough to optimize the brain.
That's exactly right. So one of the biggest problems we have is that as physicians, we have been taught to look for things that are, quote, WNL, within normal limits, or as, of course, people in medical school sometimes say, we never looked.
Right.
But the idea is that this WNL, within normal limits, is so misleading. As you well know, one can die of B12 deficiency with things like pernicious anemia or posterior lateral sclerosis, things like that. You can literally have horrible diseases with a, quote, normal B12. So if the original normal for B12, as you know, is 200 to 900, so you can run around with 280 or 300 and have significant problems. And the same sort of thing happens for many of these things. As you know, homocysteine is considered normal up to 12, but well documented that anything over 6 is actually associated, literally, just you can put it on a line monotonically with an increase in atrophy of your brain over time. So you don't want to walk around with a homocysteine of 12, even though that's WNL. You want to walk around with a homocysteine of 6 or 5, that sort of thing, if you're going to be good to your brain. And similarly, you can do the same, of course, talk about the same thing with fasting insulin and so forth and so on. So what we want to do is not look at what is within normal limits, but in fact what is optimal for your brain function. So we talk to each of these people and say, look, we're now going to treat you like a competitive athlete. It's no longer good enough since you're already coming to us with problems with cognition or with high risk for problems with cognition, either one. We want to make sure that you are optimal, not just WNL.
And what are some of the key lifestyle factors? Because I think it would be not giving this program its due by just saying, well, it's a lifestyle program. It's like healthy diet and, you know, sleep well and reduce your stress. I mean, those are, that is a component, but merely an important component, but it's not the whole ball of wax. But what are some of these key lifestyle factors that should be optimized to get the best outcome?
That, you know, you made a very good point. So people say, oh, it's just about this, or it's just about that, or it's just about lifestyle, it's just about supplements. It's not just about anything. It's about looking at the mechanisms, the basic biochemistry interacting with the genetics to understand what it is that's driving the cognitive change. And of course, what we found is that as the metabolism goes, so goes the cognition. When people come in with a fasting insulin of 32, we're not going to make them better until, if we include with everything else, we want to get their fasting insulin down below 5. We want to drive their biochemistry to a biochemistry that supports optimal cognition. So we now have over 100 variables that we look at. And we can then say, okay, once we look at these, we can now pigeonhole people and say, look, you have mostly type 1 Alzheimer's or type 2 Alzheimer's or type 3 Alzheimer's. So maybe if I could digress for one moment, because sure, before we come back to these lifestyle factors, yeah, you know, why do we call it type 1, type 2, and type 3? And we have published a paper on these different profiles. So here's the interesting science side of this. Why do organisms make the amyloid? Why do they make this stuff that collects in your brain? Here's the surprise. You make amyloid as a protective response, not a destructive response, although, of course, it does engender this downsizing of the brain. But your brain actually makes this as a protective response to three fundamentally different metabolic and toxic perturbations. Number one, inflammation or infection. So if you have things like P. gingivalis from your oral microbe in your brain, wow, you will make amyloid to kill it. It is a good antimicrobial. If you make things, herpes simplex virus, candida, a number of things, spirochetes, it turns out that amyloid is quite a good antimicrobial. Second reason that you mentioned that you make this sort of thing, is that if you have a sudden withdrawal of trophic support, so for example, you suddenly cut off the nerve growth factor, BDNF, estradiol, progesterone, pregnenolone, you know, B12, vitamin D, any of these sorts of things that are helping support neuronal structure, if you cut these off, then in fact you make amyloid as part of a downsizing program. And then the third reason is because, guess what? Amyloid is a very good binder of toxins. So, for example, divalent metals. If you've got a lot of extra mercury or copper or iron, you bind it up with the A-beta. It's quite a good binder. And, of course, biotoxins, things like mycotoxins. These are all reasons to make amyloid. So we look at the brain and we say, aha, you have Alzheimer's disease, which basically means you have a degenerative process that includes amyloid and tau, specifically phosphotau and tau, these neurofibrillary tangles. Well, yes, of course we want to get rid of the amyloid, but not without getting rid of the inciter or inciters of that amyloid. So getting back to your earlier question about, okay, so what do we do lifestyle-wise? So we want to look and see what, and when we look at this profile, we can say, okay, you're mainly because of type 1, it's an inflammatory problem, it's an infection-related problem, or you're mainly type 2, or a combination of those things. Mm-hmm. And you attack them differently, and these are personalized programs for each person. We want to pull out all the stops to get you to stop degenerating in your brain. So this includes things like, of course, reducing your hsCRP. If you are eating a ton of sugar and that's driving you to have a high fasting insulin and have high inflammatory, essentially a sterile inflammatory state, then of course part of reducing this is to get rid of that state. And by the way, a common way to get Alzheimer's is with insulin resistance. As you know, there's a very high correlation between insulin resistance and Alzheimer's disease. And in fact, Ed Getzel, a professor over at UCSF, published some beautiful work showing that if you actually look at the neural exosomes from people with Alzheimer's disease, virtually all of them will display insulin resistance signaling in their neural exosomes, whether or not they
sometimes
have
referred to type as type 3 diabetes or diabetes of the brain, where there's insulin resistance and maybe faulty sugar metabolism and, in effect, a brownout of the brain due to improper energy metabolism.
Right. And what's important to realize is that there are two parts to that. So, in fact, we call this type 1.5 because it gives you both the type 1 and the type 2. So, for example, given the fact that you develop the resistance to insulin, which is a trophic factor, you're now seeing a reduction in the trophic support because you don't respond to insulin as well. So that gives you the type 2, the reduction of trophic support. But as you alluded to, you also now have the damage from the sugar alone. So you now have the advanced glycation end products. You produce things like autoreactive antibodies. So you now have an inflammatory state also. So that's type 1. So we call this type 1.5 because it has features of both of these. So yes, we want to drive down your insulin resistance. We want to create insulin sensitivity again. We want to drive your homocysteine down to 6 or below. We want to make sure that your B12 is over 500. We want to make sure that you get 7 to 8 hours of sleep. And I mean, people laugh at me when I tell them, look, you know, sleep is contributing to your cognitive changes. And they say, well, what are you talking about? I mean, I pride myself. I only need 4 or 5 hours of sleep per night. Well, you may think you only need that much, but for the vast majority of people, of course, you need more than that. We typically do use melatonin. By the way, of course, melatonin has all sorts of salutary effects, and including things like reducing amyloid. So many things that are helpful from melatonin itself, and of course, from sleep. And then, of course, stress. Huge problem in our society. Many people, of course, walking around with very suboptimal and very high cortisols for years, and of course then ultimately having a situation where the cortisols are now too low ultimately. So you lose that support. Many people walking around with pregnenolone steel, of course, where you're losing support for the sex steroids. Testosterone turns out to be very important for supporting synaptic efficacy and synaptic maintenance. And in fact, as you know, if you're a male and you're in the lowest quintile of testosterone, you're at increased risk for Alzheimer's disease. Similarly, of course, people who are low in their vitamin D at increased risk for Alzheimer's disease. And of course, people with certain SNPs in their vitamin D receptors, increased risk for Alzheimer's disease. So everything from the way you sleep, the way you eat, the even hygiene, the things that are, again, related to chronic inflammation. Anything that supports that chronic inflammation is going to increase your risk. And, of course, we want to know the genetics. No longer should people think that, oh, if I'm ApoE4 positive, this is inevitable. People, of course, through the years have said, don't tell me about my ApoE status because there's nothing I can do about it. And, of course, we disagree with that. There's a tremendous amount you can do about this.
Well, you've beautifully laid the groundwork for our continued discussion. We divide these podcasts into two parts, and in part two, we're going to drill down even further and look at some of the components of this program, specific promising supplements, types of diet, and functional foods that can support a program of reversal of cognitive decline. Today's guest, Dr. Dale Bredesen, he is the founder of the Buck Institute and continues research on how to slow the progression and even reverse neurodegenerative disease. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.